Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Author Sunday Show with Books Forward. Today, we are thrilled to welcome writer and author Lori McCullen. She is the author of the new novel. It's called Among the Beasts, and it shares a remarkable story of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. She is the woman who saved the Everglades. She totally rocks, period. She's an amazing woman. So excited that the book is out, and Nancy and I both started reading it, and Lori is a phenomenal writer. So we encourage you to get it. It's out now through She Writes Press. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Bookshop.org, I think, is one of the best places too. But go to her website. It's lorimcmullen.com, and that's LoriMcMullen. So welcome, Lori. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, it's good to have you. I have to go and, you know, spell your name out for everybody just to prove I can spell.
Thank you.
And very excited about your book. Your writing is incredible to me because you really put us in a sense of place, you know, and just even just, you know, being that person and then just being the sense of place. I was like right there. And Nancy and I travel full-time documenting parks and public lands. And it actually started our tour in 2012, January. We took a trip down to the Everglades.
Oh, really?
We were actually doing a radio show at a tropical plant expo in Fort Lauderdale. Mm-hmm. But we said, well, you know, if we're going there, we have to go to the Everglades. And
Absolutely. We
fell in love with, I mean, and we used to live in Florida. There is a magic. There's like a quirky, crazy, mystical, swampy magic. Yeah, so this is an area that you grew up going to, right?
Yeah, so I grew up in a suburb of Miami called Kendall, and it's southwest of Miami. And at the time where I lived, it was very much right on the edge of where the Everglades began and where development ended. You know, you didn't have to go very far west before you were fully in the Everglades. And, you know, as I grew up and got older and I went away to college and, you know, as time passed, the development went further and further and further out and the Everglades got further and further away. So I felt like, you know, when I was little, they were kind of in my backyard. And by the time I left for college, they were much further away. And
wow.
Yeah, just noticing that change over childhood was really striking and said a lot about what was happening in the area.
And the Everglades, isn't it really just also important for water for Florida?
Oh, it's so important. I mean, there are scientists who could speak much more in depth about it than I can. But what I do know is that the whole entire system of the Everglades, all the way up to Lake Okeechobee, the water drifts down, you know, the rainfall falls on Lake Okeechobee, the water drifts down through Big Cypress and through the Everglades. It's so important to the water table underneath the ground. And, you know, it's the rock and the earth beneath the Everglades is oolite and limestone, and it's very porous and the water trickles down. And that water table that's under there is super important for all the big cities in South Florida. I mean, the viability of that water table is what keeps the seawater out of the drinking water reserves. And, you know, there's, again, I can't go into too much more detail than that because I'm not an expert, but it's, the entire life in South Florida hinges on the water in the Everglades.
It's kind of like the Colorado River in the Southwest. Mm-hmm. You know, we've followed a lot of the I think we've probably done the whole river. That is like a lifeline. It's like the Nile of the country, you know, and you know, there's just, you've got to look at these water sources, and we keep encroaching. And I, you know, when we were there, we could see where the farmland was also encroaching in. And we also went out, I know you even talk about, you know, the different nonprofits, like the Everglades, there's a foundation, all national parks have one, which is so important. But, you know, it's sad what happens with these places where the encroaching comes in. When we were there, we noticed that. Mm-hmm. And we didn't get to go to Big Cypress, but we did go on a boat. Mm-hmm. And we learned how to pole and troll.
Oh, seriously.
Okay.
But we went out with the National Parks Conservation Association. Yeah. And so they were talking about a lot of the work, and also like Big Cypress is always under threat for oil. So there's all of these threats in this fragile and incredibly biodiverse system. And going out on the boat was really interesting because that's where, you know, right now, for those watching, Nancy and I are in a swamp. We're in the wetlands.
Yes, we're in a swamp.
The Everglades, known as the River of Grass. But we went out in the water to see where the ocean, and then here's this wetland area, how that connects. We went out learning about all the efforts to get boaters to behave. and how they do it because of the nesting, the rookeries and the nesting birds. And so there's just a lot of work going on, which whatever we can all do, we should do.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's one of the things I found most fascinating about Marjorie Stoneman Douglas is that, you know, in the early 1900s, the 1920s, she recognized all of this already. I mean, the Everglades was not the Everglades yet, and it was not a national park yet, but she recognized its value. She saw the development that was going on with the land boom in South Florida at the time. And, you know, just the swamp was almost like there for the taking and being advertised up north as a great place to come and build, you know, to grow tomatoes and build housing. And it just, there was such a lack of appreciation of the importance of the land. And she was one of the first people to kind of have her eyes on the coming crisis of the development of Miami clashing with the importance of the Everglades. So, you know, even 100 years ago, she had her eyes on the same situation that we're still talking about and still dealing with.
And she stood up for women, too.
She did. You know, she was not a natural activist. She grew to become one. And when she was in college at Wellesley, she became involved with the an organization that was promoting women's suffrage. And she worked very hard. Her grandmother, who helped raise her and helped send her to college and pay for college, very much wanted to see women get the vote before she died. And it's something that Marjorie worked for in college. And then years later, when she ended up in South Florida, she became involved with a group of women who went and advocated before the Florida legislature to allow women to have the right to vote, which was promptly ignored, completely rudely ignored. And but she tried, and that lit, I think, a spark in her and helped her find her voice as an activist. So when she found the Everglades and found nature conservation and preservation, she had already had a taste of what it felt like to really argue and defend something that you care about.
I think from her background, through reading your book, I can feel that she developed a strength because of what happened to her as a child and how powerless she felt for such a long time. And I think that's part of what steers you into being an activist or coming to grips with your own decision-making and how you're gonna do something, when you're gonna do something, how strong are you, regardless of whether you're male or female. So I think that childhood played a huge part in who she became.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, again, this is something I don't know. As a writer and an artist, I sort of superimposed this on Marjorie's story, but I believe it is entirely possible that because of her childhood and the difficulty she felt in her childhood and experiences that she had, when she came to South Florida, when she saw the exploitation of the Everglades and the vulnerability and helplessness of the land, she recognized herself in that. Yeah. And I think that's part of what connected her so strongly to it and made her want to fight to save the Everglades. I think she really felt the plight of the land on a really internal and deep level because of how helpless she was as a child. She could see. Yeah.
You know, that's something in wildlife conservation. We've done so many, you know, interviews and been involved in that for years. And they say that those who really stand up and they're become carers because they've experienced that in some way in their lives. You know, to me, I love nature and wildlife. And I'm like, it's fragile. Mm-hmm. And when these places go away, it's going to hurt us. in the long run, but it'll be such a bummer. You know, there's so many little things, you know, survive on, you know, just like the river grass, you know, to me is important. But also something we found traveling, and that's why I got really excited when I found out about your book. I was like, oh my gosh, good. Mm-hmm. Because there were so many women in that time frame that stood up for our parks and our open spaces. Mm-hmm. There was Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Did I get her name correct this time? I get it. Well, you know, she got married twice, you know. But but there was Carolyn Dorman in Louisiana. She was an educator, a writer, an artist. And she stood up and she got into trouble because she was a loudmouth. She stood up for what she believed in and got in trouble in schools for opening her mouth as a teacher. And she continued on, and she ended up, if it wasn't for her, they would not have what is known as what is now Kisatchie National Forest. Mm-hmm. That whole forest was founded from her. There's people like Priscilla Thew in the Sequoias. Ansel Adams actually, his success in helping Kings Canyon become Kings Canyon came from her. She was mm-hmm. a photographer, also not known to do this kind of thing in the, you know, in the 20s and 30s. Huh. She went out on horseback on her own and documented it, all the area, the land, to get people to expand the park. Wow. So it's like, I want to do a whole thing on all these women. Mm-hmm. And that's just a scraping of them. They're out there and they were up against so many things, you know. Just
I'm seeing a book series.
Hello? I know. Yeah, come on, you gotta do this.
Come on.
I mean, did you write this because of you know, your connection to it, or you know, just what, who she is, you know, was it kind of, or both?
I came at it from both ends in a way. I mean, I was thinking about what I like to write and how I like mm-hmm. to write. And I, you know, when you opened the show, you were talking about the sense of place in the book. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. actually like what I'm most passionate about as a writer. I love creating a sense of place. I love making the place so vibrant that it almost feels like a character in the story. You know, it almost verges on like I get to like to be a little too poetic and sometimes have to remind myself that there needs to be a plot too. So I wanted to write mm-hmm. A book that had a very powerful place in it. And when I thought about my childhood in the Everglades, the next logical step was, hey, what about Marjorie Stoneman Douglas? I remember learning about her in school. I wonder mm-hmm. If there's any part of her life that might be interesting, because you know, she lived to be 108 years old.
Wow.
And, yeah. And most of the significant work that she did that everybody knows about took place later in her life. So when I started doing research, I looked into what her early life was like. And the more I learned, the more interesting she became to me. And then that's what I say, came at it from both ends. I mean, I thought about place and writing about the Everglades. And then I kind of backed into Marjorie's story, and they met. You can't talk about one without talking about the other. And
plus you have a crazy chase in there.
Yeah.
You got, I mean, come on, who doesn't want to be chased through the swamps? Come on.
Right?
I mean, it's like, you just,
like,
I know, it's like, there's only gators in there, but that's the whole thing. I felt like, I was like, oh, this is cool. Because the Everglades at night, that's something, you know, I know about wetlands, some wetlands at night, mostly African wetlands, but I mean, I know that you can go camp on one of those little tiki things. What are they called?
Yeah. I think they're called,
I don't know.
Tiki, something like that. Tiki.
There's something where you can.
A floating dock.
Yeah.
Sleep on the, but then you think, well, you know, there's gators in that water.
Yeah.
And so.
Or crocodiles.
What if you roll around a lot, you just fall in?
Well, I actually do have a little story about this. So. When the book came out, I got in touch with one of my elementary school teachers who was very important to me and developing my creativity. And I just, you know, of all the teachers that I've had, he's one of the ones that really stands out. So I found him and I got in touch with him and I sent him a copy of the book and we were talking and he said, Lori, do you remember the camping trip that the sixth grade class took to the Everglades when you were in my class? And I said, absolutely, I remember. Like page one of the book talks about the pink alligator eyes glowing in the darkness when you shine the flashlight. And that came from that field trip. We camped out on those platforms like you're talking about, which was terrifying.
Oh, cool.
And we went the whole class and the chaperones and a park guy.
Wow.
We went on a midnight hike into one of the hammocks where Al Capone had a moonshine still during Prohibition because we're better to make moonshine and not be found out than in the middle of the Everglades.
Wow. So,
and this was such a vivid memory to me that when I was sat down to write the book, the pink alligator eyes in the darkness of the water at night was the first thing I thought of. And I was like, this is where it has to begin. And it was just really great to be able to reach out to my teacher and talk to him about that.
Oh, you got to hold up the book for everybody. Cause you said it. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Everyone's got to see that. I love it. I love it. So too, you know, when you think about being a woman and also being out in nature, that's also something unexpected in those days. Weren't we supposed to be proper?
You're supposed to be in the kitchen,
but not heard.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. In the kitchen.
Yeah.
Having babies. That's your two most important things. Well, you know, having a husband and sex.
Right. Okay, here we go. That's it. Take him camping.
Basic duties.
So writing this, because you've got, it's a novel, yet it's not a biography, but so is the chase more, here's the fiction? Where is that kind of line?
The chase is absolutely more the fiction. The relationship with the person who is chasing her, that was very real and factual. The chase is an artistic interpretation of how that relationship ended.
No spoilers.
I remember there was a time, I'm trying to think if I remember there's two or three movies where the convicts escape from the prison and they run it at night through the Everglades and there's crocodiles and alligators.
And orchid hunters, yeah. Don't forget about that.
Yeah. So, you know, I was kind of like, it's so dramatic in the Everglades, you know. It's, I find it fascinating and fun. I think some people could find it pretty frightening.
The first thing we experienced when we drove into the Everglades, because the first thing we did was we went through Shark Valley and here's all these alligators and you're just walking by alligators. And I'm like, are you,
hello.
I mean, this was the closest we felt to like being at home, like, you know, growing up in Africa and you know, and being in the wild a lot. This was like the first thing I'm like, no way. This is America with all their rules. And you can walk next to alligators. I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah,
you know, but there's just, I mean, the Everglades where it's just like the bromeliads and the trees, you know, that we all think we just get from, you know, the local big box store, you know. It's a mind-blowing, and the gallinules, all the bird life, it is just one of those incredibly amazing areas, and she did so much with it. I think also you talk about, you know, learning about her in school, which is important because a lot of these women don't make it to be, right? But this is your local history, which is important to have museums and schools interpreting her. I wonder about, you know, the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas at that high school. Those teens came out so fast and stood up to speak so fast that I thought, wow, I wonder if it's just, you know, here, that's her name, that's her school. I wonder if they were like embodying her spirit, like when they stood up to speak.
I absolutely agree. I think about that a lot. You know, I finished the first draft of the book just days before that shooting happened.
Oh, wow.
And I, you know, it was one thing that I thought was really remarkable. I spoke to you before about when Marjorie went to speak before the Florida legislature about women's suffrage and was completely ignored. So almost exactly 100 years later, those Parkland survivors got on a bus and went to Tallahassee days after the shooting. And by the time they got there, the Florida legislature had already decided not to bring a bill to the floor about increasing gun control laws. So, you know, the kids were on their way there and the legislature had already shut down what they were coming there to advocate for. And it just was such a parallel to Marjorie's experience when she argued before the Florida legislature 100 years before.
Yeah, it's just like that whole, even, yeah.
Yeah, but I can't help thinking that, you know, just like Marjorie's experiences in her childhood and the traumas that she experienced shaped her into the activist she became, I think that, you know, so many of those survivors and those kids from that school that bear her name are going to be able to harness their tragedy and fight for the things that they believe in throughout their lives. I think she would be very proud of the kids that came from the school. That's her name.
You know, I think we need to have a balance in politics where it's equal in number between male and female. Because until that happens, I think when it comes to gun control, you know, as females, we're the nurturers. As men, they are the protectors. So there's a deep DNA difference there.
Yeah.
And I think that's always going to affect voting when it comes to, oh boy, I'm going to get so much trouble.
Yeah, I'll get emails. Here they
come. There you go. But when it comes to like the woman's right to control her own body, let me put it that way. And then there's one day we talk about gun control. Mm-hmm. Those two things, they're almost male and female. And since our balance isn't correct in our Congress and Senate, I don't know how we'll ever get to control what happens in our neighborhood, in our schools, shopping centers, and somebody having a gun or a right to a gun. I mean, I recently read Texas just says, now you don't even have to have a permit.
Yeah.
Like, well, that really makes a whole lot of sense. Thanks, guys. You know, I don't know.
The thing is, you should be able to speak up. And I think there's a lot of fear in that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, if we speak up, then okay, half our readers will go, no, you need to believe the way I believe. Otherwise, you know, and that's not really, I hope we can get to a point of conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah,
I think that's the key, is conversation. I mean, I think most people are reasonably minded and can talk to each other and compromise and see other people's perspectives. And if those people can have their voices heard and actually listen to each other, I think that's where there's room for change.
Does writing the novel, is that also part of it for you, for wanting, you know, readers to be inspired to make positive change?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think on a number of levels, you know, even environmentalism aside and feminism aside, I think that, you know, it's a story of a woman who overcame a lot of challenges and was able to find the strength to make the choices that were right for her, even if they were unconventional and not what she was supposed to do. And I think like that's a valuable message that I hope people take away from it, whether or not they care about the Everglades or not. You know, it's, I think there's that aspect of her story that almost every woman could relate to.
Yeah.
It'd make a great movie. It really would.
The chase scenes would be pretty exciting.
But to write that, it's interesting because you talk about being poetic in the sense of place, and then having those chase scenes, you really have to have a sense of place to feel the heartbeat, you know. And so is that the style of writing, I mean, writing chase scenes and putting action in there, is that something you've always wanted to write it, or is it just suddenly, oh, we need to do this?
The chase scenes, so it, for people,
those are hard.
The novel alternates between the short kind of urgent chapters that are these chase scenes and then longer, more reflective chapters that look back on the rest of her life. And so, you know, the chase scenes serve a few purposes, right? I think they help move the narrative forward. There's a little bit of suspense there and it propels the story. But it also, it wasn't so much the chase that I've always wanted to write, but kind of really indulging the lyrical and kind of very flourishy language aspect of things. I knew that kind of writing couldn't be sustained through a whole novel. And so by breaking it up into chunks like that, I was able to indulge this very theatrical writing style that I like without overdoing it.
Yeah. So. That's because it is hard. Yeah. It's, you know, especially with nature, because when you're setting up a scene of nature and you really are observant, you see all these things, these magical things, and it is poetic. I mean, nature is, you know, this visual poetry and audio, you know, it's this amazing, it's poetic, no matter how you look at it. And to be able to write that and then not overdo it, because you feel strongly about that.
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
Right. And words are amazing to play with. I mean, do you ever write songs or?
I've tried poetry, but not songs. I'm not a musical person.
But poetry is, I mean, it is connected. I took a whole bunch of my poems and turned them into songs and just had to change it up a little bit. But I mean, if you like that kind of thing, but that's the thing about even travel writers and natural people who write about nature, there's that balance because you also want to have that creative fiction, nonfiction thing going too. There's that balance.
Which is why I think historical fiction is so fun. You know, there's the acts of her life and then to be able to build on it and enhance it and like make kind of metaphorical connections that aren't necessarily there in real life. I mean, it's really a fun adventure.
Did you do a lot of research on her, like going to museums, or is a lot of her information out there?
Yeah, you know, I looked through the University of Miami archives. They have some stuff online. And the Miami Herald, which is the newspaper she worked for that her father founded, I found some old archive articles that were very helpful. But the most helpful thing was she wrote an autobiography with someone else, and it's called Voice of the River. And it's very, you know, it's not done in her usual writing style, which is very florid and lovely. And it's very like kind of matter of fact, this is what happened throughout my life. So that's what I used as kind of the most foundational piece of my research.
So if you could make it into a movie, I have to ask, would you choose to play her?
That's a great question. I'm not sure. So at the time she would be about 30 years old, maybe, Keira Knightley, if you're listening, Keira.
I immediately go Meryl Streep.
Because
she's got that tough character of, you know, getting,
she would be good too,
I mean, it's just, she's just such an incredible story. And I'm so glad you've kept her story alive, because these women are so important. And also, you know, in the environmental sense, you know, women, you know, you think about Diana Fossey, Joya Adamson with Elsa the Lion, Nancy worked with her in Kenya in the bush before she was murdered. These were all, you know, back in the day, you think of biologists and naturalists and activists. It was mostly, oh, the men do it, not the women going out there in the wilds, you know. But look at, the most important one that,
Well, there's Jane Goodall.
Thank you. I need coffee. It's Monday morning. We're recording this, people. You know, you look at what they're doing, and they went out there in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, it's inspiring. And today we have so many women biologists and naturalists out there, out in the field, in the swamps. Doing all this amazing work, documenting so we can, you know what needs to be saved where, which is pretty much everything everywhere. So are you going to go back to, I know you're in Chicago. Do you miss Florida? Do you go back to the Everglades?
I do miss Florida. My brother still lives down there. And so, you know, when I go down to visit him, we trek out there, and there's a, it's not quite in the Everglades, but in the Redlands, which is an agricultural area that butts right up against the Everglades. There's farm stand that we love.
That big one. That really,
Knott's Berry Farm, I think it is.
Knott's Berry Farm. It's not, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And we take the kids there and we go out in airboat rides, things like that. I do. So.
Yeah, that we had fun the first year. We did the Shark Valley. We did an airboat. I'm in two minds on that, of whether animals like that. I'm weird about that. I've done it, and it was cool. It is exhilarating, but I don't. And we did a show with the National Parks Conservation Association. I brought that up, and they're like, environmentally, they are much better than, you know, half of the boats. And so it's just but we got in through the main, we went through the main entrance, and we stopped at this one area. The first thing we saw were those big black vultures
Yeah, the turkey.
The big black ones, not turkey, the big black ones pecking at people's cars, and people had, you know, all around their windshield, their tin foil and all kinds of stuff to stop them from pecking at that. And I'm like, this is cool, man.
Right.
I don't know. It's just so diverse. I want to go there again. We need to go, Nancy. We're going to Florida this year. We need to go.
Yeah, and we have to see manatees too. That's on the list.
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll do that. But so when we get there, we'll call you. We're going to go, hey, look, here's our gators. Here's our gators. Yeah. So what's next for you? Because I know you've done publishing in other magazines and things, and now you've got your debut novel. So do you get to go on a book tour, or do you have to Zoom around? What's going on?
I've been Zooming around. When we set up these plans, I wasn't sure that, you know, COVID would be in a place where we could travel. And so I've been doing some Zooms and some virtual bookstore events, which has been really fun. There's some really cool indie bookstores in Florida that have been very excited about the book. And it's been really fun to find these places that I probably wouldn't have found otherwise.
I'm glad to hear it, because the more independent bookstores, the more we can support them, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's been great. And, you know, this whole experience has got my mind percolating to the next book, which I hadn't thought I'd be ready to think about for a while. But it's funny, the excitement around this book coming out just got the wheels turning. So I am looking ahead to the next one. So
okay,
it's going to be a book series.
I know. I think you should cover all these women.
Yeah,
did all these? You know, there's a lady that did the Raptors place up. There's just so many women that have done this environmental work. It's exciting. That's really cool. I'm again really glad you have your story out. I can't wait to keep reading it. It's like we're like nonstop kindling. very good. Well, keep us posted. Good luck with your next book and what happens from here. I hope you do some book club events, because I think that would be really great. And especially I think in Southern Florida, people are going to really want to connect even further. You know, it's their backyard. So but thank you so much. And everyone, again, Lori's a website, and it is, let me go get it. Lori McMullen and So LoriMcMullen.com. And the book again is Among the Beasts. We also want to hope you stay tuned with us here at BigBlendRadio.com. Our shows air Sunday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific time, 7 p.m. Eastern time. So thanks, everyone. Thank you, Lori. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you.